Welcome back or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and in this episode, we are talking with Kelly Newland, the owner and chef of Real Athlete Diets. Real Athlete Diets, or RAD for short, is a catering company that focuses on feeding ultra-endurance athletes. We focus the first half of the conversation on her experiences and insights supporting well-known runners in our sport on fastest known time projects, and then we focus the second half of the conversation on her interests in and knowledge of the athlete-sponsor relationship in our sport. This was a great episode. Before we get started, though, this episode is brought to you by Gnarly Nutrition, Kodiak Cakes, and Inside Tracker. Use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout to get 20% off Gnarly products. Use code SINGLETRACK15 at checkout to get 15% off Kodiak products. And go to insidetracker.com/singletrack to get 20% off your next order there. Okay, with that, let's begin. All right, Kelly Newland, it's an absolute joy to have you on the Single Track Podcast.
Thank you, Finn. Thanks for having me. I feel like I've been waiting for this for a while, so I'm humbled to be here.
Right on. Well, I think, you know, you only recently came on my radar, but then I realized you're extremely well known in the community. So there probably are a significant number of listeners out there that are familiar with what you do and the value you provide to our community and your interests. But can you give a quick overview of like Real Athlete Diets and I guess how you got so integrated into our community?
Yeah, it's a question I get often, even from folks that live in the Front Range. So we're located in Boulder, although we live up a canyon in the foothills of Boulder, Colorado. So we're almost 9,000 feet up here. But in a nutshell, I am a lifelong professional chef, and I started running when I was a kid, meaning 5 years old. And I feed endurance athletes. So a catering company focused on feeding endurance athletes. Like that's my elevator pitch when people ask what I do. And yeah, we feed runners, climbers, cyclists, schemo athletes, you name it.
This is something that is absolutely fascinating to me. And I'm wondering, like, with your clientele, are you mostly interfacing with the brands in our sport and then from that relationship working with athletes in the program, or are like individual athletes in our sport that care about dialing and nutrition, et cetera, are they personally reaching out to you? And that's how it works. I'm very curious.
Yeah, that's such a great question. We are now 8 years old this month in October. And I would say the first 3 or so years, it was individual athletes that we focused on and worked with. And through that, became friends with them. And then what just sort of organically took place was, let's say if you run for Solomon, Kat Bradley was one of our first athletes that we started feeding on a regular basis. And Kat was with Solomon at the time. So through our relationship with Kat, Solomon then learned about us. And then Solomon as a brand, their athlete manager would reach out to us, or their marketing director, which is often kind of an overlap, right? So it really started with the individual athlete and then the brand. And we still work with both in both capacities, but it's so, one, it's always nice to see and not surprising when an individual athlete reaches out, but I love so much when a brand has the awareness of knowing that they need to feed their entire team well. So they hire us instead of just ordering, like, I don't know, Domino's pizza or Qdoba, right? Like they get it. And that to me is growth. Like seeing that is good stuff.
Is there, going beyond the brand, like, is there a typical one-on-one athlete relationship? Like if you and I were to work together, would my kitchen be your workspace and you'd be preparing meals around the clock? Or what does the standard relationship look like when it's one-on-one?
That has changed and kind of evolved over the years as well. You know, the first 2 or 3 years we did a decent amount of individual meals, and that's sort of what it looks like when we would sponsor an athlete. So we don't do individual meals anymore. We're more event-based, and I'll put a pin in that and jump on that in a minute. But when I work with an individual athlete nowadays, it's let's say you have an FKT coming up and you're like, hey, I need, I'm going to do the Colorado Trail, so I need X amount of days, or this is my goal anyway that I think is going to happen. So I need food for me that looks like these different items or different options that have a specific caloric intake, right? So some might be 100 calories to 200 to 300. X amount of times a day for X amount of days. And then you might also say, hey, can you also provide food for my crew? So we make that in our commissary kitchen in Boulder, and then I deliver it to you. So I'm not taking up more of your time. I'm removing that stress level of me being in your face. I'm basically just right about the day before you leave or the morning that you leave, Finn, I would show up with a cooler and hand it off to you, or hand it off to your crew, better yet, like whoever, kind of like if you have a crew chief, I would hand it off to them. So that's what that looks like. But it would be a rare occasion for me to cook in your home. Does that answer your question?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And I know you've worked on various projects in recent years. Maybe we can talk about the Colorado Trail, for example, in a second, but going back just a little bit, I'm curious, has your focal point in terms of feeding athletes always been the ultra community, or have you branched out into other spaces like mountain biking world and swimmers and stuff like that?
My husband's a cyclist, so road and mountain biking. He loves cyclocross, bikepacking, that sort of thing. So that's always been a part of it. And then skiing, climbing. But no matter what, we do work with road athletes, you know, like road runners and cyclists who race on the road. But I think it's kind of human nature, right? Like my heart is in the dirt. So that's kind of the focus of where our work goes, mostly athletes and sports that are in the dirt, but definitely endurance. We're probably not going to feed your local 5K, but we will show up at, you know, 100 miler or 50 miler, that sort of thing.
So earlier you mentioned that events have become really a major focus for RAD, and I'm guessing when you say that, at least one of the pieces is all these athletes that are going after fastest known times on these long trails. And this is really interesting to me because the space is just evolving so fast. And when you add not just having like an on-site coach and some crew, but another awesome variable of like a nutritionist or a personal chef, I'm just amazed at how fast this space is evolving. So you're right on the front lines. Can you comment on what that's like in the conversations that you have with these athletes that are like leaving no stone unturned when it comes to execution?
Yeah, it's really exciting. And I love that you can see that. You're able to see a change in that and how things work. So I'll use Nick Patatella as an example. Nick lives here in Boulder, and he's also a friend and an exceptional athlete, as most of your listeners would be aware of. The end of August of 21, Nick made an attempt for the Colorado Trail, and he has the FKT. But we sat down, Nick and I met at a coffee shop in Boulder after a few emails, and he had already spoken with the nutritionist that he was working with, which was great. And he was able to provide that info to me. And then we kind of broke down, like, this is what he needed each day for X amount of days for the goal he was going towards. And he had options. So we separated things into like 100 calories, 100 calorie pile, a 200 calorie pile, or a 300 calorie pile. And then his crew chief, Julia German, who's also an ultra runner and an exceptional climber, she had all this information. So I also communicated with Julia. And when Nick would come in, she would keep track of the amount of calories that he had been going through and go through his wrappers at you know, each station. And then she would pick from certain things from the pile. And then in that conversation, there are also so many other variables, like, you know, you're exhausted and you're eating constantly, right? So you're tired of chewing. And Nick was like, around this time, I'm going to get really tired of chewing and my mouth is really going to hurt. So I need things that that are softer or easily digested, right? Or easy to just easy intake. Outside of like things like a gel. So we would do things like a mashed potato burrito or something that was just soft, that was not going to be uncomfortable for him to eat, that he was still excited about and could get down. And then on top of that, he was really conscious about having food for Julia. And Julia, fortunately for me, is also a friend, and I've fed her before. So I know like when she's tired or frustrated, things that are going to be comfort foods for her, and things that she can easily grab when she's tired because she's driving all over the place. So there are different components and layers to it. But he crushed it. He did amazing. And it was really easy for Julia to navigate what food to grab for him and also keep herself going through the process.
It's funny. I was just finishing rereading Jenny and Scott Jurek's book, North. And, you know, part of what makes that story so fascinating is they basically went in with little to no logistical preparation. Like, you know, they were very vocal about, we're going to on-site this and we're not going to reach out to many people for insights on what to do and how to do it. And like that was only 6 or 7 years ago. And now we're at this point where even for something relatively shorter, like the Colorado Trail, which is like 6, 7, 10 days long at most, people are just taking it that much more seriously from a logistical standpoint. So I'm wondering, I guess where I'm going with that is, do you see your contribution as a significant competitive advantage to what the athlete is doing out there, where like maybe they're not carrying their own food and they're not limiting their choices, but you're creating really all of the best, healthiest options for them?
Gosh, yeah. I mean, it's sort of undeniable, right? I know that if you ask Jenny, hey, Jenny, if I rolled up at all these places where you were parking your van so you didn't have to feverishly drive all over the East Coast, would that have been helpful? Her response would undeniably be, oh my gosh, yes, I could have used that. Like, because she was just, it was nonstop for her, as you know, because you've read the book. Yes. So yeah, I think it's a key piece. It removes so much stress and whether you have crew there or not, especially if you don't have a crew, maybe if you have drop bags or something somewhere, having that already done. So you know, Nick has a full-time job. He's not someone who's independently wealthy. He, in preparation for all of this, he was still working full time and took vacation days to do this. So by removing some of that stress from him, I know that relieved some of the stress and just emotion from his head, so he could focus on just going out and running. And then having, you know, your crew taken care of as well. Because let's face it, right? Like, we're always the last ones to take care of ourselves. We take care of everyone else as the crew chief. And then you're like, oh my gosh, I haven't eaten in 24 hours. So if you have that already there, like your crew already has a step ahead of taking better care of you.
I think one of the things that I'm interested in is just the insights you've picked up over all of these experiences with different athletes that are setting out for FKTs, because I imagine most of them are thinking about like a playbook for nutrition, like what I'm going to eat day 1, 2, and 3, what I think my body is going to want, how I'm going to respond to it, the energy it's going to give me. But then I also imagine that like once they're out there and it's live, things can happen. Their stomach can turn, or maybe they're just like craving something relatively unsophisticated, like a Snickers bar or a piece of cake or like a beer. And, I'm wondering if you can just share any interesting insights you've picked up that might make you do anything different with future projects that you're working on.
I think the first thing, the first conversation I have, people are often, they kind of like hide what they're eating from me. They think I'm going to judge them. I mean, my own husband has a snack drawer that's full of candy bars that he thinks that I don't know about, but I know.
I'm the same way. I hope my partner's not listening.
I'm not going to judge you. I don't care, especially if you're out in this huge attempt, right? Like, The first conversation I have anymore, especially if it's with someone that I have not worked with, is like, look, I know this is what you think you're going to eat, but I'll tell you within 72 hours, you're going to want pizza. You're not going to want any of this stuff. So let's have, and that's okay because you want those things, right? Right. We want those because our body is depleted in certain things or requires something that, you know, like you're just burning calories nonstop. So the fuel that we are craving at that point, we don't have any control over. Like, you're not going to be out there eating kale. That's not helping you, eating fistfuls of fiber. So the first conversation I have with any new athlete for a project like an FKT attempt is, let's chat about food. You're going to give me all this information, but I also want you to know, you and your crew to know, at some point way earlier than you think, you're going to want something completely different. So we need a box of junk food. We need a box of candy. We need a box of, or we need all these other things. And like, then we have the conversation of, all right, when you're out in the middle of 100 and you're at mile like 70 to 80, what is it that you've been craving? Like, what crazy thing? Is it a cheeseburger from In-N-Out? Is it pizza? Is it, fill in the blank, but what is it? And then we make sure we have things that are similar, if not that exact same item, available. So when the time does happen, that is there, because we can, you know, it's that age old, plan your race, race your plan. But then if you don't know how to function when the plan falls apart, you're screwed. So being able to have that conversation beforehand is, that's the clutch move.
I'm not sure the right way to phrase this next question. This is kind of stream of consciousness, but so after reading Scott's book, you know, he talks about how it totally inadvertently, I think he lost like 18 to 20 pounds along the trail. I was just listening to an interview with Carl Meltzer, who had a different experience on the AT. I think he might've lost 2 or 3 pounds. And I don't want to get too caught up in like the losing weight type conversation, but I'm wondering, like, when you're talking with these athletes and you're talking about like a nutrition strategy, is part of the goal to stay as close to their original baseline figure, like along the trail, or and is that possible? And is that something that should be strived for? I'm not sure where I'm going with that, but like I know that that has been a big debate on a lot of these long trail FKTs. So I'm curious the role that having like an on-site cook can play in that.
Yeah, I think that's an important question. And we can, you know, shift that focus to, because I know that can be a sensitive subject, but I think it's a really important subject because, yes, and everyone burns differently, right? Carl's built completely different than Scott. Carl also eats ribeye. Scott is vegan. So there's, right, there's different challenges there. And as far as, you know, we all know they're going to lose, especially in a really long attempt like the AT or the PCT, something like that. We all know that they're going to lose a certain amount of pounds in there. But the big thing is, you know, try not to lose too much. Or maybe there's a window that you have that comfortable conversation within, like, all right, we really don't want to lose any more than this. And it's really not about like, oh gosh, you've lost X amount of pounds. It's, have you had sufficient fuel to keep the strength up to continue the project that is still at hand, right? And I think that's where you're going with.
That's what, yep.
Yeah, so I'll tell you, Scott's most recent AT attempt, I was actually fortunate to provide food for him for that. And what that looked like was, a couple conversations with Jenny, and, I created specific things, focused around that conversation or those conversations. And then I just dropped like some boxes and coolers off at their house. And then they went off to the trip, with that food. So here's the difference now with versus North, you know, during North, which you just read, there's all kinds of just different things that are scattered, and they were sort of new to it at that point and did not know exactly, and how could you know, right? Didn't know exactly what he would really need at that point. So Jenny's driving all over the place, at random places, in North Carolina, West Virginia, right? Just everywhere. And this particular trip, I had made over the past couple of years, we started making these vegan meatballs, which are really tasty. I promise those of you that are meat eaters, they do not suck. They're really good. And Scott was like, "Hey, one of my favorite things when I was a kid before I turned vegan was the Egg McMuffin with sausage." So he has a was starting to work with a company, Just Egg. I don't know if you've seen that product before, but
Yes.
it's fantastic. I eat it almost every day, probably 5 days a week. I have Just Egg scrambled eggs. So he had the Just Egg, English muffins, cheese from I think Violife, and then I made him using the same recipe that we use for our meatballs, with a bunch more of just kind of like breakfast sausage sort of seasonings. We made him sausage patties. And then the plan was for him to have one of those every day before he went out, which was great because it was fat, carbs, protein. It was a little bit of everything. And it was also a pre-known sort of comfort food for him. And that was just a really neat sort of adjustment. And it was just so black and white from first attempt to second. And inevitably, Scott did get injured, which was a total drag, but he was so prepared for it. And he was so strong.
I really appreciate all this behind the scenes, and especially so because I think there are a bunch of listeners that are athletes themselves out there, and at some point in time they want to be in a position to go after one of these long trail FKTs, or they're just fans of the scene. And I guess the last question I want to ask in this area is, and it could be within your work cooking food for these athletes, but are there any other interesting insights or just things that you found fascinating while you were out on the road with these athletes, working with them, that you think the audience would be interested to hear about?
I guess I can't stress enough that the importance of the willingness to and the fact that they do, like the people that are successful with these, especially really long FKTs, and again, I'll use PCT and AT because they're just such iconic distances, right? The athletes, once they get to a point, they're like, I don't care. Like, this is what I'm craving. It's all out the window. They're able to adjust and pivot, and they recognize the importance of the caloric intake they need. And so many of us that are kind of just starting to, or maybe kind of our fans, but have not done these things successfully yet, are so, on the outside, it looks like we're watching these athletes who are eat like, they're weighing their pasta and their rice. Like, that is all out the window, in the thick of it. So don't be so hard on yourself. Don't judge yourself by what you, if something happens and all of a sudden you're like, 3 days into something and you are literally craving In-N-Out burger, eat the In-N-Out burger. Just if it's
Amen.
whatever it takes, because your goal is likely to finish or a specific time. Your goal is not to eat, carrot sticks and hummus. I don't think that's the goal of people, but you're probably not going to get too far if that's all you're, if the way that we eat daily at home or just regular training at home is not the way that you will eventually be eating for these long FKTs. And that I think that's really important for people to know, the behind the scenes.
I want to pivot the conversation a little bit. One of the most recent common themes on this show is just having conversations about the state of the athlete-sponsor relationship in our sport and ways that we can create more opportunity for athletes, but also create more value for the brands themselves. And I have friends on both sides in both arenas, and I know you do too. And I think I want to have this conversation because you've actually, in addition to running rad and cooking great food, you've been to some extent on the inside of some of these experiences. So maybe we can start with, like, how did your interests develop in this area?
It was pretty organic, Finn. I would deliver food to athletes or events that we do for brands, whether it's I'm staying with an Adidas at a VRBO for a week for a team training camp, or I'm with Solomon for 10 days at a VRBO for Pikes Peak, I inevitably will spend time with the athletes and get to know them. And I'm hired by the athlete managers for these brands. So over the past, 7, 8 years, I've just become very good friends with both sides of the, most of my friends are athletes, which is why I do this. So I can, hang around my friends, just basically feed my friends for a living. But the athlete managers as well, when you spend that much time with them, you become friends with them. And then we have trusted friendships and relationships. So it became obvious to me when I would, show up at someone's house and drop food off, they'd be like, hey, would you just as a friend, would you just take a look at this contract that I'm trying to figure out right here? So many people are like, well, you're not supposed to talk about your contract. You can absolutely talk about your contract, especially if it hasn't been signed. If you haven't signed anything, you should absolutely reach out to someone who's an attorney or someone who has experience in these things. So I always encourage people to do that. Once the contract is signed, that's a different story. It's kind of like anything in life. When you're a teenager, you learn, whether it's your parents or whoever your first boss is, it's a life skill to know that you shouldn't be talking about what your hourly rate is to other people that you work with, right? So that's a different conversation. But I would see these contracts and the questions they would ask were usually pretty similar. And then I thought, gosh, so many people are asking these questions, but they're not asking these questions. So I started to ask, as my friends, I would ask them, have you thought about this? Or what about this? Did you ask them about what happens if this happens? And they're like, oh, I haven't asked that. And I'm also fortunate to have friends that are like in their 20s, some that are in their 30s and 40s and 50s. So again, as we go on through life, there's certain questions that we know to ask because of just life experience, right? Or like Anna Frost, this isn't her first rodeo. When she looks at a contract now, the questions that she asks now are different than the questions she would have asked as a 20-year-old. So that happens an odd amount of time to me, that actual sort of scenario of a friend who is an athlete asking me, what do you think of this contract? And it became really obvious to me that there needs to be something to help these athletes. And then I would also, on the flip side, athlete managers would be like, hey, we're looking for 2 new people on our roster. We need 1 man, 1 woman, or we're looking for 1 person. It needs to be someone that fits these things. Who do you know? Or specifically, hey, we're looking at this athlete. What do you know about them? Have you heard, are they easy to work with? Like, what kind of backdoor info do you have on this person? So it became really obvious that there was a need here, right, to help both sides. And I loved your comment about, things on both sides. So when was it? Maybe 5 years ago, with a couple of friends, I started an organization called the Athletes Coalition. It's no longer active, but people still reach out to me on a regular basis, especially this time of year, because over the next few months, contracts will be solidified. So the Athletes Coalition, we had an attorney on hand, someone who's in the outdoor space, and then myself. And again, I think your listeners are probably like, she's a cook. Why is she helping these people? Yes, I am. By trade, I'm a chef. I also have a business degree, and I have spent my life in this. I've been in the endurance sport space longer than probably 50% of the athletes that I feed have been alive at the age of 52. So I'm oddly connected, and because I've been in the community for a while, I'm also just a trusted friend, which is why you feel comfortable with someone, so you ask them for advice. So that's where that's the space that I hold. A couple weeks ago, a younger athlete who was renegotiating a contract reached out to me and was like, hey, do you have some time if I send this to you? Can you look at this and let me know if it looks parallel to what other brands are paying someone, an athlete like me, and then we can chat, which I love. And this person is in their early to mid 20s at best, strong racer, and is really kind of, I can see he's growing, like he's growing up. It's becoming a little bit more responsible. He understands, more of a professional. And the questions that he had were great, but there were also three or four that I was like, all right, now I want you to hear these questions, and this is probably what you should be asking also. And I know the questions that he should ask because I work with the athlete managers and I know what they're looking for. So by him asking, it makes him look more professional. He's becoming more professional because now he's learning. And three, they're all really important questions. They're all things you should be asking. So it was a great conversation. And he signed his contract already and he's so stoked about it. And he felt really empowered.
I have so many questions to ask you off that. I want to talk about the Athletes Coalition a little bit more in a second. But what are, like, if we were to create a list of maybe like the three or four non-obvious but super important questions that athletes should be asking when they're going to the table with a brand, what are some of those that you kind of shed light on for athletes that come to you with questions?
Yeah, I think the first one is for women, which is really obvious, what happens to my contract if I get pregnant? And the parallel to that for women, or for men, and also women, this is also for them. Like, obviously men cannot get pregnant. However, they can get injured. What happens if I fall and break my leg in the middle of the season or the beginning of the season? What happens in my contract? If your contract is frozen, then they're like, okay, well, do you know what frozen means? And they're like, no. I'm like, so you need to ask, what is your version of frozen for that particular sponsor? Years ago, I was in the audience of a panel. It was all women, all professional sponsored athletes from Patagonia, the North Face, La Sportiva, Salomon, and there was someone else. Actually, I think there were a couple TNF athletes in there and a couple Salomon. It was like 6 to 8 women. And at the time, this was probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. At the time, women were really starting to finally have, like, feel like they could use their voice in ultra running and ask for equality and just being for equality in every way in our sport, right? So I raised my hand and I asked them, each person on the panel, what happens if you get pregnant? What happens to your contract? And the conversation before that was how outraged they were that an athlete that they knew had gotten pregnant and her contract was frozen. And then I asked them what happened with their contract. One person on that panel knew the answer, and that person happened to be pregnant. So my point here is we can be as outraged as we want with what a sponsor does, but if we're not advocating for ourselves and asking the questions to begin with, it works both ways. It is our responsibility to advocate for ourselves. So knowing how to do that is vital. And then the next day, almost everyone on the panel sent me a message. They were like, I just reached out to my sponsor. Thank you so much. I don't know what I was thinking. And I'm like, if you have a uterus, you can get pregnant. You need to know this question. And then for the men, it's the injury and or women injury, right? And then there's another really cool question, which is if it's not on your contract already, ask just outright. And this is a really great way to be like, I think my contract's okay, but I it feels light, like monetarily. Ask if there's a stipend for travel, ask if there's a stipend for race entry. And all 90% of the time of the conversations I have, that's not included. And almost every time someone asks about it, if they're like, hey, can I get this? These are the races that are in my head on my calendar next year, and this is how much each of those races cost, and this is how much it will financially cost me to get to these races. Can you cover that? And if they're like, well, we can cover this, but not that, then my next question to the sponsor is, well, what races do you want me to be at? What races do you want your athletes to be at? And then, all right, this is where I live. I live in Arizona. They want me to be at these races. It's this far away. Calculate the travel, calculate the race entry. And if ask them then, all right, if these are the races you want me to be at, then you need to pay for my travel. I need a travel stipend and a race entry stipend. So having that conversation is really important.
Just because I'm actually admittedly unaware, what does it mean when a contract is frozen?
Let's say you fall and you break your leg and they're like, okay, you now can't race. You can, and if you're like, well, it's going to be at least whatever this many weeks. And then I have rehab. And then by the time, so I'm off for 4 months, they will, and let's say most of the contracts are paid, twice a year or quarterly. Quarterly is probably the big one that I've, the biggest pattern I see lately. They'll stop paying you until you can actually race again. And if you can't race again for like 6 more months, you've lost 2 quarters, you've lost half the year. Or if you're pregnant.
In any of those, yeah. In any of those cases, is termination a possibility too?
Yep, which is another really big question. So that leads to another question as well, right? Like, what would be cause for termination? Or what if I get into this? I think it's always a smart idea, like if for an athlete to just start with a new brand, someone they've never been with, sign a 1-year contract and see how that feels. You might have the best year ever. You might be like, oh my gosh, I can't wait. I'm counting the days to get out of this contract. It was not a good fit. It's like any job interview, right? When you're interviewing for a job, it's just as much you interviewing that employer as it is them interviewing you. So a 1-year contract is always feels a little bit safer, especially for a younger athlete or someone who's like, I've never been sponsored, period. So this is what I think it is. So if they sign into a 3-year contract and they're like, oh my gosh, now I'm like, it's like a record deal, right? You're like, great, I have to be with these people for this long and I just don't feel good about it. So yeah, did I answer your question?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I have so much.
I know it's so much, right? There's so many layers.
I think I'm probably going to ask you questions that are all over the place. And this one is just at the top of my head. I think because of the nature of social media, everybody, myself included, I am just as much of a transgressor here. We only tend to post the highlights and the gratitude and just generally like the positives that are happening. And I think that extends to the athlete sponsor relationship without implicating anybody. And I don't want to do that. Do you get a general sense that both sides, both parties involved in this relationship are generally happy about the way things are? Like the athletes feel like they're being taken care of. The brands feel like they're getting marketing value and storytelling, et cetera, from the athletes.
Oh, that's a loaded question. gosh. At this present time, it feels better than it did, let's say, before COVID. There was a lot of bubbling up going on right before COVID. It feels a little bit more positive right now. But I think that it's probably, you know, there are at each level, right? You have, because we've got kind of tiers of athletes that are, you know, in within your sponsored athletes for each brand. Gosh, I think it depends on the brand. When I think of, there's one brand in particular, and I work with them a lot. I work with a lot of their athletes, and I know those athletes feel taken care of, but those athletes are paid well. They're taken care of in many different ways, but there is also a lot asked of them. And I love the balance. I'm just going to say it. It's Adidas. there's a great balance of if someone's like, I want to be sponsored by Adidas. I'm like, absolutely not. You are not a good fit for them. And what I mean by that is, I know what Robert expects and I know what Adidas expects. And the athletes that he works with, they are so well taken care of, but it also works both ways. Those athletes have a laundry list of, they're like, these are the campaigns that we need to work on. This is because Adidas is this giant machine, right? Those athletes are involved in, they've got calendars of like, all right, we're sending you this product. The campaign starts on this day. Every one of you needs to tell an organic feeling story around X product, right? It's a job, and they do it. They do it well. And in turn, that team is, there's no other team. If someone reached out and again, and they were like, I'd really love to work with Adidas, like, and I know that person is not a team related kind of focused person, I would let them know right away, I don't know that you're a good fit, and this is why. And I would absolutely not connect them to Robert. And if Robert reached out and said, hey, what do you think of this person? I'd be like, yes, that person's perfect for Adidas, or I'm not sure, and this is why. And then Robert is a pro, you know, he's not going to just take my word for it. He'll, if he really wants to work with someone, he would probably focus on those questions with that athlete. I haven't sent him anyone in a while, but Corinne Malcolm was the last person that I sent to Robert. And, you know, she has a great relationship with them. But so I think it's like, we'll put Adidas, like those athletes, they know what's expected of them and they're happy. And Adidas and Robert is their athlete manager is happy. And then there are other brands that it's maybe kind of 50-50. Right. I think if the brand and the brand or the athlete manager is dialed enough to really be able to communicate with their athletes and explain what is needed and the athletes are truly on board with that, it has to work both ways. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but happens, that rare sort of alchemy takes place, then we have like this amazing positive relationship. But, you know, we're all humans, we're all different. So it could never be 100%. But I think it's, each brand is a little bit different. Sorry, I know that was probably such a crazy answer.
No, that was brilliant. I'm interested. I'm wondering, let's just say for the sake of argument that Adidas is like the gold standard in terms of both athletes and the brand feeling like it's a mutually beneficial partnership. Do you think that Adidas currently is on its own island of quote unquote excellence here? And if so, do you think they're having an influence on other brands in that playbook of how the relationship should unfold over time?
First, I want to say I'm not in bed with Adidas. I'm not on their payroll.
Neither am I.
I work with so many different brands and have great relationships with them. But I would love to see anything. Patagonia is another one. Exceptional. They have a very specific, like, when I hear someone that says, I want to be with Patagonia, I'm like, all right, what do you stand for? And there's crickets. Like, they don't have it. There's nothing about the environment. There's nothing that they're living for that I know is a focus, that we all know is a focus of Yvon Chouinard and Patagonia as a brand and each of their satellite sports, right? So I think those two are really exceptional and up there. I hope that, like anything else in life, when we see somebody that's at the top of their game, we all are like, oh, that's what I want to achieve. So I would love to see that. I would love to see brands, or I'd love to know that other brands and brand managers and athletes managers see that they have this bit of growth to become stronger and offer more or have just a tighter relationship. Anytime we, you know, we all have like a hero or somebody that we're like, that's what I want to do. I want to grow to that. And I want to give a shout out while we're doing this to Aaron Cooper from Salomon, who's their athlete manager, who over the past couple of years has just put such a focus on women in sport and women in running and moms specifically in the Salomon events that she is a part of and organizes. It's a game changer, and that is undeniable. it was a week or two ago, there was this huge Salomon, was I think it was a half marathon for women.
Yes.
And Erin just knocked it out of the park. And I'm still hearing people talk about it, which is fantastic, right? And part of me, as a, as a trail runner, and I grew up on the track and ran on the road, but part of me, when I see brands that are that feel like they're trail brands or dirt brands, as I like to call them, branching, they're like, now there's this new focus of road. I'm like, gosh, I feel like they have an identity crisis. So I'm always kind of like, I'm gonna watch and see what happens there. But with Salomon, Erin has been able to embrace road and trail with running, at least with running, because she's that's her focus, and do something really unique with them. And the unity that she's brought together, that makes me feel like they're not pulling away from the trail running that helped get them going, right? She sees where they can be stronger, and she's done it.
I want to go back to the Athletes Coalition just for a second. It sounds like it was part of your mission to help educate the athlete side of the market and give them some of the resources they needed to come from a place of information when talking with brands. And I guess I'm wondering, just based on the work you were doing there and the research, et cetera, the conversations, what do you, does it boil down to one thing when it comes to why athletes don't know what to ask early in their careers?
I don't think so. I think it's like any other industry, whether you're in the music industry or the restaurant industry, like anything, it's life experience. We don't know until we know it, or until someone else has mentored us with it. So I don't think it's one thing. I think it's life experience, which is why it feels so important and felt so important, especially at the time, to start something like the Athletes Coalition, because we need to be there to help each other. We could be there to mentor each other. And in the way that we share, albeit confidential, we're still learning. Like, I don't need to know the brand that's doing A, B, or C, but knowing that they're doing it, that someone's doing A, B, or C is important and can provide tools. So within the Athletes Coalition, we absolutely would help people kind of troubleshoot reading a contract. And then Julia German, who was our attorney on staff, she would could go through the contract with the athlete. If necessary, she would represent them and be on a call with the brand when that time came, just to troubleshoot questions, because she acted as their counsel. She's an attorney, so that was all within the scope of things. But our goal was to help answer questions for the athlete, let them know if it we couldn't be like, oh, you're getting screwed because this brand is offering or the same brand is offering this person much more. We could be like, this contract looks good. What they're offering you is on par with what they're offering everyone else in your kind of tier. But we would never be like, oh yeah, they're offering Finn this, so whatever. Like, names were always left out. Other brand names and monetary values were left out. We would say, let's see if we can get you more, and this is how you're going to ask for it. So at the end of it, the hope was by the time the next contract rolled around for them, they had the confidence to do it on their own, or they would just have a couple questions instead of starting from, square one. So it was really just helpful in mentoring and allowing them to feel safe and giving them like a platform to like comfortably ask the questions and learn, right?
As I've had conversations like the one we're having now, I've increasingly recognized that I personally bring a lot of biases and assumptions to the table. And I think one of my biases is that any athlete that's out there looking for a contract or looking for sponsorship wants this to be like their one thing at that moment in time. Like, they want this to be their job. And I recognize that that's probably not accurate. And I'm wondering if, like, just based, again, based on all of the experience you have here in the conversations, is it fair to put athletes and brands in buckets about what they both commonly clearly want out of the negotiation? Like, can you say one or two things that like the athletes definitely are looking for, or is everybody super different?
That's such a great question. They're different. And I think depending on what tier, there's the tier we think we're at and the tier we're really at, right? So we have, let's say, fill in the blank athlete who has won local races and is their dream is to be a sponsored athlete. To them, it's exactly what you said. It's this is going to be my career. It's my one shot. And when they get a contract and it doesn't say, here's $50,000, they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, you have to stay working at your local shoe store because this isn't going to happen. So it's, I think keeping, there's certain athletes that will always stay in a bucket and certain brands that will always stay in a bucket if they don't change. You know, for the athletes that feel that they've made it and they deserve X amount of zeros on a contract, like any other thing in life, until we're humbled enough to learn that we don't deserve everything we think that we should be getting, until we do deserve it, right? Until you've paid those dues, until you've proven, we're gonna stay in those buckets until we can climb ourselves out of it, right? And the brands are the same way. There's some brands, and you see when there's a change in athlete manager, right? Or a brand manager, you see a change and then a shift in what the brand is looking for. But there's still, you know, there's a couple brands that you're like, oh man, they've just kind of been doing the looking for the same thing for the past few years, or they have these set like 3 to 5 athletes who have really been carrying them along for the few years, and until those athletes leave, they're going to stay in that bucket.
You just reminded me. I'm curious, how pivotal is, let's call it, the worldview of a particular athlete manager versus like the strategy and the worldview of their entire marketing team? Like, does the way the athlete manager sees the sport and the relationship matter a lot, or are they more controlled by the rest of their team?
Oh, I love that question. I think it depends on the brand. I know that's probably not the answer that you're looking for. Oftentimes, you know, the athlete manager is in that position because the brand manager, they have what the brand manager is looking for. They have the same view, right? So it's all copacetic. Yeah, so this is what happens. You know, there's like marketing director and this sort of thing, and the athlete manager's budget is, depending on the brand, is often just within that budget or just deeply connected. So that they might the let's say if you're the athlete manager for single track, you're like, all right, this is the budget I was given to use for my athletes. It's X amount of dollars, and then you're like, okay, these are the athletes I'm interested in. I'm gonna pay them. Each person's gonna, like, you know, most people don't all get the same because of where, you know, everybody's value is different, honestly. So you fill all of your paperwork out and you're like, all right, my budget's capped. I spend every dollar on these X amount of athletes, and this is where it all divides up. This person's getting this amount, this person's getting that, and then you turn it in and you've made the decision. The marketing team is not going to make the decision on who the athletes are. You are, as the athlete manager.
Are
Unless
you
you're
okay to go
something
for
totally crazy, like you're picking, I don't know, Dennis Rodman, and then someone might step in, or maybe they give you more money, I don't know. But it's the athlete manager is definitely, they're building a team, you know. Do you know Laurel DeVore with Vibram? Have you met Laurel?
Not yet.
She's wonderful. She came from Ultra, and she's an exceptional athlete herself, and she's the athlete manager for Vibram in North America. So she's building this team over the past couple of years, the very first ever team, and she has a really the direction she's been given from Vibram is very clear. They wanted athletes who could kind of cross over in sports because Vibram is, you know, they're skiing, they're running, they're climbing, they're everything. So she built her team. The people that she chose for her team were all very specifically chosen. It wouldn't just be someone who's like just a I don't know, just a climber or a trail runner. And the person that she built her team around is very specifically Meredith Edwards. I don't know if you know Mare, but she's
Yes.
climber, she's a crazy skier, exceptional mountain athlete and runner, and Mare is like the epitome of the Vibram athlete, and then everyone else is built around that. So she's like the flagship athlete for Laurel's team, and then everyone's kind of built around that. And then, you know, she'll have kind of up and comers, and you know, you want to make it so like not everybody ages out at the same time, or people like, you know, Meredith can then mentor someone who's younger than her, or there's a great mix in there. So Laurel is just the perfect example of someone who's like cherry picking exactly what represents the brand from her team, but also that she took so much time and put so much effort into just researching and picking every one of the athletes on that team. And yeah, it's good stuff. It was so cool to watch.
We've been talking a little bit about how the landscape is changing, and I'm wondering if you have your eyes on any particular trends in this relationship, like team sizes and investment in trail versus investment in road, stuff like that. Do you have any thoughts to offer there?
Yeah, I think, well, and there's two very specific examples, right? We have Ultra and then we have Salomon, who've really kind of made a push for road running over the past few years. It might have even been right before COVID, I think, that they did that. So there's definitely something going on there. And my guess is, I mean, to be honest with you, I don't know for sure because I do not work for them, but in my own just sort of thoughts, it's got to be those, like, road is untouched for them still. So like, how can we grow the brand? Okay, perfect. Road. That makes sense. I totally get it. And money. There's so much more money in road running than there is trail running. So that makes sense. I can't fault them for that. It feels icky to me because both of those brands were really built on trail. My humble opinion, I'm big fans of both companies. But you know, as long as they still take care of the trail athletes and trail industry that gave them so much while they're doing this, I'm on board with it, right? Because we all love to jump on the road. And at some point, you know, there's this pattern of road racers, when they retire, they're like, I'm going to become a trail runner. So then they go back to trail running. So we can all coexist. There's plenty of room for both. But I just, my hope is that they still take care of that. They don't forget about this while they're growing that. Right. As long as that happens, I think it could be a smooth transition. And that will, you know, we'll kind of point back to Erin Cooper on that, because she's really been pivotal with Salomon in that. And then what was your other question? It was,
well, like team, like, for example, other trends, like team sizes and stuff like that. Like, I know Adidas Terex, like, one of their like principles is really consolidating the number of athletes on the team so that they can really take care of each one properly.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of that. And you and I in the past, or a couple weeks ago, had spoken about what was the program? Salomon Young Guns program years ago, which was so cool. I remember reading about it, I think, in Trail Runner. I was like, that's the coolest name ever. I loved it. And it was this big campaign for up-and-coming athletes to get signed with Salomon. I don't even remember how many years ago it was, but it was just groundbreaking. So what they did was bring on all these great young athletes. And then all of a sudden, what happened, from the outside anyway, it looked like they had so many athletes. It was instead of like, it was quantity, not quality. And what I mean by that is not the athletes were not quality. That's not what I mean. What I mean is, when you have this budget and you have 10 people, it's easy to take care of those 10 people. But when you have that same budget and you have 30 people and you're just giving them, you know, a fistful of dollars to each of those, you know, 30 people, let's say 20 of them were the young guns, that's difficult. And it's difficult to build loyalty within your team, right? It's difficult to, for everyone to feel like they're taken care of when, can you imagine an athlete manager that has like 30 different people? Or, you know, Salomon is pretty cool and they have like Salomon Global and Salomon North America. And then some of the athletes that lived in North America that were absolutely 100% American citizens were somehow global, but they didn't, they lived in the United States, so they were often forgotten about. So I love the size that Salomon is now, but it was really painful to watch all of those athletes one by one get dropped. That was really hard. And I spoke to so many of them. And that's actually how Corinne and I ended up with our conversation and how she got to Adidas. She's like, I just feel so defeated right now. Corinne is a really loyal person. Whoever she's with, she is all in. So I knew that whoever she ended up with needed to be a team, a brand, and an athlete manager that would really also embrace that and offer that and appreciate that loyalty from her, which is why to me it felt like Adidas was a perfect fit for her. But she was one of those people that started, I don't think she was in the Young Guns program, but she was one of the athletes on the Salomon team when there were a lot of them. Again, you know, I think it was a great idea at the time, but it's like a lot of things, we do something and then we're like, oh, that didn't work out so well, or it worked out well until it didn't. And the athlete managers, gosh, I can't imagine the work, like trying to keep everyone happy when you have that many athletes, that job feels impossible.
Well, the last question I want to ask you, again, recognizing one of my biases, which is I just think that, like, I think I'm under the assumption that growth and opportunity for the trail running space is inevitable, a foregone conclusion, which is probably not correct. Given what you know on the ground level, do you think that there's still more growth and opportunity that we're going to experience in the next few years? Or are you more pessimistic and maybe think that we're already at a high point when it comes to opportunity for athletes?
I think we're at a high point, but I think we can go higher. I do. I do see growth, and I'll use this parallel. Western states, right? We've got Dylan Bowman, and again, I'll use Corinne. You know, they have this whole, and Billy Yang is leading the charge with their media of like live coverage, and it's this big thing, right? And then we have Hard Rock, which is my heart. Dirt roads, tiny mountain town. It's still like old school. They don't want to grow too big. So we've got some things that do want to grow and some things that are like, we're good staying where we are. This is what we represent. That's why I think we can still grow, because we need both. Western states is California. Western states is obviously where it all started, right? So to me, that is a race that feels like they're doing what they need to do, what they want to do, and what they should be doing. It feels organic for them to do that. And it also feels like races like Hard Rock are right where they should be. And then we've got all these other little cool races, little, I should say, new races coming up, or newer, like High Lonesome with Caleb Efta, race director, right? He's, I think he has three or four different races now, but that's a race that's making a huge dent in our sport and becoming so popular. Caleb is never going to have live coverage and have us this big, like, crazy circus, because he doesn't want to. His growth will be different, but each of them is important in the way that they are growing and or evolving, because we can not grow, but we can become stronger with what we are without growing, right? As far as these races go, like High Lonesome can become stronger in so many ways without becoming this Western States giant, right? And Western States can grow into this amazing different version of itself. So I think with each of these kind of all these little things doing what they need to, our sport will inevitably grow. It might not grow like wildfire. It might be little blips here and there, right? Like Zillow. But I think there's always possibility for just endless positive trail growth. And trail growth to me feels like stronger, smaller steps instead of giant like Boston Marathon steps of growth, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Well, Kelly, I want to thank you deeply for your willingness to answer all these tough questions. I know I personally learned a ton from this conversation, so I'm assuming the listeners feel the same. Grateful for your just energy and that you decided to invest so much of your life's work in our community. I'll make sure to plug Real Athlete Diets in the show notes, but do you have any specific calls to action or final thoughts that you want to convey to the audience?
Gosh, I will say this. I would love to just give a shout out to the brands, the athletes, and the races that are putting such a strong focus on environmental awareness right now. And whether that's Dakota Jones with Footprints or Patagonia or gosh, fill in the blank. There's so many right now, and I love that pattern. That's my favorite piece of growth right now in our sport is that awareness and that people are taking steps to do something about it. I love that. So thank you to everyone who's doing that. And yeah, that's my biggest sort of shout out there.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Kelly. And I hope somewhere down the road we have an opportunity to do around two here on the pod.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Finn. It's been great. Thanks for having me on.